Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'm DNW ILL AM 580, based here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to have as a guest one of the leading consumer activists in the United States, someone who's been active on a whole range of crucial issues, not the least of which is the financial crisis. Joining us for the full hour, so sit back and relax and enjoy today's show. But before we go to our guest, let's go first to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Thomas Jefferson would have been proud. On May 14th, more than 500 people packed a room on the seventh floor of the museum in Washington, D.C. to discuss the state of journalism, public media, and the Internet in America.
At a moment when technology and media are rapidly changing, the Free Press Summit explored the future of the Internet and the fate of journalism in the 21st century. But surprisingly, the 200-year-old words of Thomas Jefferson took center stage throughout the day, beginning with the opening remarks by John S. and James L. Knight Foundation President Alberto Ibarguen. He recalled Jefferson's famous quote, "If I had to choose between government without newspapers and newspapers without government, I wouldn't hesitate to choose the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them." That second line, "everyone should receive those papers and be capable of reading them," is often left out. But as Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver explained,
"Jefferson understood the importance of linking distribution and access and engagement with actual production of journalism. The problem, though, is in modern Washington, questions of media and those of infrastructure are treated separately. They operate in their own silos of law, policy, and advocacy, and this separation has to end. We need a strong market for journalism and freedom of the press, and we need to ensure that information reaches all corners of the country and that everybody can engage. We must and can have both."
Free Press released a new book at the event called Changing Media: Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Some of its authors took to the stage to present their research. Research Director S. Derek Turner spoke about how the blame for America's broadband failure rests with the Federal Communications Commission.
"Before the ink was even dry on the 1996 Act, the powerful telecommunications giants and their army of lobbyists went straight to work obstructing and undermining the competition the new law was intended to create. By the dawn of the 21st century, what they could not get overturned in the courts was gladly undone by a new FCC eager to deregulate these corporate giants, all in the name of the free market. So instead of protections against monopolies, consumers have been left with high prices, few choices, and a duopoly of phone and cable companies."
Senior Program Director Craig Aaron talked about why journalism should be considered a public service, not just another commodity.
"So what should we do? First, we need to agree on what we're trying to save. This is not just about newspapers. It's about newsrooms and news gathering. This isn't about protecting old institutions or propping up old business models. It's about serving local communities. And it's really about understanding that journalism is a public service. It is not just another business. And the crisis we have in journalism is a national issue that requires a national solution."
Acting chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Copps, covered a range of issues and proposals for change at the FCC over the coming year, from stronger public interest obligations for broadcasters to the national broadband policy the commission has been tasked with creating.
"Every generation faces the challenge. And today, strengthening democracy means building media democracy. The media agenda is at the center of democracy's agenda. If we work at it, really work at it, you and I can realize a dream. Us now."
Susan Crawford, a member of President Barack Obama's National Economic Council, also spoke. She affirmed the president's commitment to high-speed broadband access for all.
"Broadband, it's the new essential infrastructure. It's true that access to broadband doesn't guarantee economic success, but lack of access to broadband will guarantee economic stagnation and decline."
And NPR President Vivian Schiller declared that her news organization was positioned to increase investigative reporting.
"But I feel we have a special responsibility also to expand in the area of investigative journalism. We do some, we do it very well, but we don't do nearly enough."
A highlight of the event was a roundtable with moderator Ray Suarez of PBS, Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott, Senate Commerce Committee's Jessica Rosenworcel, venture capitalists Ram Shriram and former FCC chairman Reed Hundt and Michael Powell. Here's Michael Powell.
I think that the Bush administration did fail in that the president and the White House never committed to the broadband policy, and I am much more encouraged that the current president speaks of it.
Next week, Media Minutes will take a look at the afternoon session, which shifted the focus from the speakers at the front of the room to the participants who were seated at the tables.
To see the speeches, read the report, and a whole lot more, visit freepress.net/summit.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you with a program that could not be more timely. Our guest today is the co-director of, or the director of Essential Action and the editor of the Multinational Monitor. He's also the author of a brand new report, Sold Out, How Wall Street and Washington Betrayed America. His name is Robert Weissman, and it's a pleasure to welcome him. Rob, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And you also blog at multinationalmonitor.org, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Is there anywhere else people could find your work if they want to check you out online?
Well, some of the advocacy work is at essentialaction.org, and our work on the financial crisis is at wallstreetwatch.org.
And let's dive right in. The financial crisis now is entering probably its 8th or 9th month since it's become a full-blown crisis of the system, global economic system. It's been percolating for a lot longer, as you know better than almost anyone. You know, I think that there's a lot of, we're going to talk about the media coverage of the financial crisis. I don't think it's going to win a lot of great awards, the lion's share of it. And I think there's a lot of confusion among people, even people who follow the news closely, about the cause and consequences of the financial crisis and sort of what's going on now with the bailout and the various programs to resuscitate the financial system. You know, could you walk us through a little bit, you know, what the origins of the financial crisis are and what steps were taken that put us on this path?
Sure. You can situate the financial crisis in different levels of complexity and abstraction, but maybe the easiest place to start is with the housing crisis. The overall financial crisis is rooted in the home lending practices of the big banks. And a lot of that involved subprime lending, as people know, which is lending to people who don't have top-quality credit and often involves abusive and coercive terms. But it really was not a problem just of subprime lending. It really was the lending that fueled the entire housing bubble. So the origin in the lending practices is with all this massive lending for homes, some of which were inherently bad loans, the subprime and predatory loans. But there was this bigger problem of lending for a housing bubble. With the bubble now burst, you've got a lot of outstanding loans that are for larger sums than the value of the home. A home might have been worth even $700,000 2 years ago, may now be worth $500,000 or even less. If the loan in the first place, if the mortgage loan was for $600,000, that's a problem for the bank and it's a problem for the homeowner because the home is not sufficient to pay off the value of the outstanding loan. Now, that was done on such a large scale that it's led the banks into this disastrous place. But that's only sort of the lending part of the story. The bigger question is why were they able to make so many bad loans? Why did they, what was their interest in making so many bad loans? They obviously presumably didn't want to put themselves into insolvency or on the brink of insolvency. And what are the things that they've done to exacerbate and make exponentially worse the problem that stemmed from the bad lending in the mortgage area? So the very short version of that is that there's been this massive deregulatory effort in the financial sector over the last 10 years, but really going back at least 30 years. It's a bipartisan affair. It was made much worse during the Bush years, but it is in the most current phase deeply rooted in the Clinton years and a lot of the people who are now involved, a lot of people who are now playing top roles in the Obama administration. And it does go back even before then. But we saw all kinds of deregulatory efforts, including lifting the rules that not long ago prohibited commercial banks and investment banks from being joined together in the same corporate entity. The consequence of that was you had the investment bank culture, which is high-risk investment for high return, infused into the commercial banking sector. You had the refusal to enforce existing rules against predatory lending. There are a lot of different rules that were that should have been applied and were not. There was a failure by Congress to adopt new rules. You had the freedom given to the financial firms to engage in all kinds of selling of exotic instruments, which they themselves invested in. A lot of these are known as derivatives and these weird terms like credit default swaps and so on. And that, for a while, was making them a ton of money, so it seemed like a really good idea to them, but it turned out that they were making money by selling things to people that those people didn't understand, even if they were allegedly sophisticated investors, and which the banks themselves didn't understand very well, as we now know, as they've taken massive losses following from the collapse of the housing market. So all that deregulatory stuff enabled these companies to engage in reckless lending and in reckless financial practices, and there were many more. The use of derivatives and all these kind of fancy financial instruments enabled them to gamble on their loans, and to which led them to do a variety of things. Different kinds of financial instruments led them to spread the damage from these loans to other parties who weren't banks. So it's not just banks that make mortgage loans who actually hold mortgages anymore. It's been spread throughout the global economy. Then you had the derivatives that were basically bets on top of the performance of those loans, and they made a lot of bad bets and ended up losing a lot of money, which made them much more vulnerable than they otherwise would have been. So you've got this whole toxic stew of really terrible performance by the industry that was enabled and permitted by deregulation, failure to enforce rules. Then the last question is, well, why did the regulators fall down? Why did Congress remove existing restraints on Wall Street? And the simple answer there is money.
Yeah, well, Rob, even before you give that simple answer, I mean, something that a lot of people might not understand is, what were these regulations that were deregulated away? Why did they exist in the first place? Why did we have those to begin with?
Well, the origin of a lot of these laws, and really the whole framework for banking and the financial sector in the United States, evolved out of the Depression. And they were responses to a lot of abusive practices in the financial sector, which very closely parallel things that took place earlier in this decade once the financial restraints were removed. So we had, obviously, a financial disaster in the early 1930s. There was a real honest and hard look at what had gone on at the time and really important restraints imposed, including, for example, that separation of commercial banking and investment banking. That was the more or less the framework for financial regulation for the next 40 years without much erosion, and still for another couple decades afterwards. But really, it started to fray a little bit in the 70s and 80s, and then really the financial sector started going after it harshly during the Clinton years and continuing through the Bush II debacle.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Rob Weissman, the director of Essential Action and the editor of the Multinational Monitor. He's talking to us. This is a pre-recorded program. He's talking to us from his office in Washington, D.C. We recorded it just a couple days before going on air, so please do not try to call in and ask questions. Sit back and relax and let us do the talking. We've been talking about the global financial crisis, the origins of it, what explains it, then the whole instance of deregulation. And Rob, I've heard, I just want you to answer this, periodically I will hear the blame put for the financial crisis on poor people who took loans they couldn't afford, or Democratic politicians or liberal politicians who created policies to make it easier for people without a lot of assets to borrow big loans to buy houses. Is there an element of truth to that?
There's no element of truth that the blame lies with poor people or with rules that were designed to expand credit. There's an important rule called the law called the Community Reinvestment Act, which obligates banks to make credit available in the whole community that they serve, including in low-income communities. The loans that qualify for Community Reinvestment Act status are not predatory loans. So they're not the worst form of loans. The Community Reinvestment Act has actually done a really good job of democratizing credit to some extent. It hasn't gone far enough, but it's done quite a good job, and it's imposed good affirmative obligations on the banks. What is true is that there was a bipartisan agreement on the deregulation that did occur. And it's also true that a lot of people took out a lot of loans that they weren't able to afford. Now, there were people engaged in kind of low-level speculation, either on their own homes, but more often on other homes. Someone might actually own another home and try to rent it, or they wanted to flip it, hoping that they could take out a loan, sell it 2 years later, and just benefit from the financial bubble, housing bubble. Some of them made money, and some of them got caught holding the home when the bubble burst. But the broader phenomena of poor people stuck with bad loans reflects some who probably shouldn't have been given loans, but they were really tricked into the loans. They had all kinds of extraordinary terms that people couldn't reasonably understand because they weren't properly disclosed. And if they had understood them and really understood the consequences, then they would not have taken the loans out.
You know, Elizabeth Warren recently was interviewed, and we're going to talk about her in a little bit, the professor who's in charge of oversight of the bailout package. And she was talking about changes in our lending industry and credit industry in the past 10 or 20 years to where it's, you know, we no longer just lend money for interest rate as we traditionally thought, but it's become a trick and trap environment where the real profits come with tricking people into paying rates that would be traditionally considered usurious by any standard.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure true in the credit card area, but even in the housing area, you saw really high rates where you'd have loans that would start out with a low introductory rate and then in 2 years' time jump up to really extraordinary rates. The only story that people could tell themselves or be told and buy into if they actually tried to think this through was they'd be able to refinance within 2 years because interest rates were low and the value of their homes were going to go up for eternity, which was a really important part of the story that people, this bubble was central to what took place, and people were convinced that the bubble would continue inflating for forever. Even during the course of that story, if it had played out for forever, the reason the banks liked the story was they kept getting all the upfront fees in providing the new loans, which were really quite substantial, especially as they tacked on all kinds of extra closing costs. But in fact, the bubble could not inflate for forever and became a total disaster for people once the bubble burst.
Rob Weissman, last September, when finally the you-know-what hit the fan and we were told basically we were in almost a lockdown mode for the global economy because of the credit crisis and the financial crunch, the impression given to Congress at that time by the Secretary of the Treasury and by the head of the Fed was that something had to be done almost immediately or else the world economy could almost disintegrate, go into a deep, deep depression, the likes of which we'd never seen before. Was that an accurate concern at the time? Was that an accurate claim that was the state of the crisis in September 2008?
Well, it was legitimate. I mean, it wasn't just, I don't believe it was it wasn't a trumped-up story in, say, the weapons of mass destruction were. The people who were saying that believed it to be true at the time. Now, there's a few things to be said about it. And there was some objective reason to believe that to be true, especially as the credit markets were freezing at the time. One thing is they provided the money, and the world economy tanked anyway. Another is that even if there were things were very severe at the time, it didn't require providing $700 billion, which was a sum taken out of the air, $700 billion in blank check funding for the financial sector. There were a whole bunch of things that could have been done that would have showed an emergency response, provided substantial resources for the financial sector, but had some meaningful accountability and said, well, if the government, that is the public, is going to infuse hundreds of billions of dollars into the financial sector, it expects to have some control over how the financial sector operates while it has that investment in and going forward afterwards as well.
One of the things that was striking about the immediate bailout that came into place last September was that Democratic candidate, now President Obama, almost led the charge to get the bailout passed, drawing in recalcitrant Democrats and backbenchers to get them to vote for it. And it sort of suggested that there was an interesting political calculus going on in Washington, where you had the Democratic Party actively pushing for a financial bailout that was, you know, very much the product of Wall Street and the banking industry. And it led me to think then of what a guest in this program, Kevin Phillips, once argued, which is that over the past 20, 25 years, finance capital, the financial interest, have to a large extent migrated to the Democratic Party and more or less taken it over at the commanding heights. What's your sense of how the politics, the lobby of the finance industry, the banks plays out in Washington? And what is the difference at this point between what Bush was doing and Obama is doing, or what the Republicans stand for and what the Democrats stand for?
Yeah, you have to look carefully and appreciate shades of gray, for sure, to know the difference. But we look backwards at the campaign contributions of the financial sector over the last decade, from 1998 to 2008. They contributed about $1.7 billion in federal elections and spent $3.4 billion on federally registered lobbyists, so $5 billion in political investment during that period. So that's quite an extraordinary sum in Washington standards, and it buys you results. About 55% of the money went to Republicans, but that is only because the Republicans held control of the presidency and especially Congress during most of that period. Now we're seeing the numbers flip, where the funding is about equal with a slight advantage to the Democrats. At the highest levels of, when we talk about the financial sector, that's broad. It includes everything from Wall Street to commercial banks to the insurance industry. If you look at the sort of the avatars of the financial sector, Wall Street and the hedge funds, they definitely slant a Democrat these days. And they've had an enormous influence over the policies of previous and this Democratic administration. There's really little, I think one of the great disappointments of the Obama administration is the almost total reliance on people who are from Wall Street or have a Wall Street ideology to develop the economic policy of the administration, and especially in terms of the financial bailout and financial regulatory rules, we're seeing it crafted really in conjunction with Wall Street and absolutely from a Wall Street point of view. They are doing some things that are different than what the Bush administration would do, but not so much, I don't think, in the area of the bailout. I think that the stimulus plan, which was a good thing, although overly slanted to try to tax cuts to try to get Republican votes and probably too modest, was much better than would have come from a Republican administration. They are doing some things that are okay, insufficient and inadequate both, on the mortgage crisis, and I think the Republicans probably would have let that go without doing anything at all. But in terms of the financial bailout and I think that there's very little difference that you can see, and maybe their we don't really know where they're going to come out on new regulations for the financial sector. That may be somewhat better than where a Republican administration would have come out, but it's hard to say.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Robert Weissman, director of Essential Action and editor of the Multinational Monitor. You can find his work at multinationalmonitor.org. He writes a blog there that covers a lot of the issues we're talking about today and has access and links to a lot of the research he has done and his organization has done. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it 3 days before going on air, so don't try to call in today. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the program. We're going to keep talking about the financial crisis and turn to a few other issues later in the hour, but first we want to nail this down a little bit more. Rob, what about the press coverage, the media coverage, the journalism on the financial crisis? How good of a job is the average American, how good of a job is the media doing at keeping the average American abreast and understanding the situation and knowing what the policy options are?
Well, there are a few things to say. One is that it is really complicated. That is a, and it doesn't, not that it has to be, but the plans that are coming out of the administration are unbelievably complex. I think intentionally to try to confuse people about what's going on, and in part to try to spend a lot of public money and make available a lot of public money without people recognizing how much is at stake, and to avoid going back to Congress, because Congress is not of the mind to give additional funds for a bailout. So it is very hard to understand what's going on. Of course, that should be an extra duty on the media to explain it. But in fairness, there is an inherent complexity to it. I think a lot of the business press is doing a really good job of reporting on what's going on. And I think we're just not seeing really good reporting outside of the business press. I mean, it's extraordinary reporting in the business press, but not very good outside. An exception was with the AIG bonus scandal, which was really helped crystallize things for the media and was something that was much simpler to explain. Now, a lot of people say that the bonus scandal was a distraction and not really a core issue. I disagree with that because I think that the incentive structure from Wall Street bonuses actually had a huge amount to do with why the firms imploded, that actually there was an interest by the traders and the executives alike to engage in very risky activities if that had short-term payoffs because their bonuses were tied to short-term performance, even if there were long-term risks. So I don't view that as a distraction at all, but I think there's a really notable contrast in the media coverage around that, which was pretty decent, and it made things pretty clear to people, and the media coverage around these much more complex things where, for example, the Treasury Department is proposing a new complicated bailout scheme to take the so-called toxic assets off the books of the banks and possibly putting several hundred billion dollars at least of public funds at risk in the process, and certainly providing at least an equivalent amount of public support to the banks without any clear appropriation. That's just what I just said was hard to understand, and it's just getting very little attention in the regular reporting. I would say one other thing about this, which is if you go back before the crisis broke, the reporting was really awful, awful, awful. So there was a lot of happy cheerleading of the housing bubble and an almost complete failure to report on the handful of economists that were warning it was a bubble. It was actually not that hard a thing to predict because the bubble is out of line with all historic trends. Those people were ignored, not given good attention. You have in the main newspapers the real estate section, which started providing all kinds of misleading advice to people. You had the business channels, the business networks, which became cheerleaders for the rise in Wall Street, which really was itself largely, although not totally, a consequence of the blow-up in the housing market. And I think one piece which remains is that this personal bugaboo of mine is on cable programming, including the news or even on the Internet sites of the mainstream papers, this very prominent display of the Dow and how it's ticking, you know, every second. And it's kind of like watching a horse race. There's some inherent interest in seeing it go up and down as it goes because it's always changing in the way that other things don't. But the effect of having the Dow everywhere around us is to confuse people into thinking that the performance of the Dow is an indicator of how the economy is doing and something that they ought to be cheering on. And that's just not so. If it has any meaning whatsoever for the economy, it's a follower. I mean, the Dow ultimately is just a reflection of the profitability of business, and the profitability of business, to the extent it means anything that the public should care about, is just going to be a reflection of the well-being of the economy. So it's derivative a few times over. But it often is reflecting all kinds of meaningless trends or things that are actually harmful, like laying off workers or lowering worker wages, boosting business profitability, and seeing the Dow tick up. And it really ought not to be confused with a real check on how the American economy is performing.
You know, one thing, Rob Weissman, I'm having difficulty getting my head around, and I haven't seen much press coverage, or maybe I'm not looking in the right places, is sometimes I talk to people like yourself who follow this closely and really are checking what Congress and the federal government are doing to bail out the financial system or stabilize it. And I hear sometimes that the Fed, the Federal Reserve Board under Ben Bernanke and Secretary of Treasury Geithner are actually doling out literally in the trillions of obligations to the financial sector with, as far as I can tell, no public discussion of it. I've heard numbers as high as $10 trillion total, the sort of obligations the public is taking. Am I just talking to the wrong people? Is this actually true? And what are these numbers coming from? What are they talking about?
They are valid numbers. It is correct that it's being done with no or virtually no, probably no, oversight, and almost no reporting, not even that much, in the business press. There are more programs of the Fed than almost anyone can count. There must be very few people on the planet who are able to track all of these things, if any. I mean, maybe Brank knows everything that's going on. These trillions of dollars that are being put in play are different kinds of supports for the financial system. Sometimes they're buying assets. Sometimes they're providing guarantees. Sometimes they're providing discount loans. Sometimes they're buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Sometimes they're providing guarantees on other federal agencies' expenditures. In a happy world, and it may turn out to be a happy world, almost all the things that the Fed is doing, as distinct from the money that Congress allocated that the Treasury is doling out, will not cost taxpayers or the Fed anything. The idea is that they are buying assets that they're real value, but they're making loans at reasonable rates. But what they're trying to do is overcome the failure to provide credit by a lot of the private agencies and sort of get those markets moving again through a variety of efforts by themselves, buying assets on those markets or by providing low-cost credit to lenders so that they can move money out. Again, if all works out, it really shouldn't cost taxpayers. And they may not be bad things that they're doing. Of course, it may not work out. What is for sure bad is that no one has any idea what this stuff is, and that when Bloomberg, the news agency, has filed a Freedom of Information Act request to try to identify recipients of several trillion dollars of Federal Reserve supports, they were denied, basically on the grounds that it would undermine faith in the financial system and people in the public or in the financial markets were able to identify who was getting these public supports.
You know, Rob Weissman, so I listened to you talk, and I've been following the story. You know, I can't help but think of the recommendations of economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Jamie Galbraith and others, both of them have been on this program, that, you know, we're paying a lot of money or putting forward a lot of obligations to resurrect our private banking system that's in default, that's in collapse, that if we just we could take a lot less money and just take over the system and get it back on its feet and then turn it back to private interest down the road once it's solvent. To me, it seems like we'd save a lot of money that way, and there'd be a lot less risk because we'd have the chance to really make sure credit takes place.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. What the Obama administration is doing is deploying every possible method they can to avoid declaring the big banks insolvent, which many believe them to be, notwithstanding these recently concluded stress tests, and scheming that if they can wait the crisis out long enough, that the ongoing profits from the banks, you know, who are making money, for example, by charging us fees on credit cards, can overcome the losses that they accumulated, and eventually everything will just work out, especially if it's supplemented by these monies from the Fed and the different programs from the Treasury Department and so on. It is conceivable that that approach will work. It will delay the fix in the credit market for a long time, and it will, in the best-case scenario, put hundreds of billions of dollars or more of public money at risk with no real upside for the public. So it's a really unattractive approach, even in the best-case scenario. They explicitly are doing it because they don't want to disrupt things, and I think, in fact, because they just really don't want to take on the prerogatives of the financial interest. It's a really striking contrast to the way they're handling the auto industry, And I agree with you absolutely that these institutions ought to be declared insolvent. We ought to have public control of them. The mess ought to be cleaned up as quickly as possible. And that the public ought to then say, we want to run the banks the way we want to run the banks. We don't want the banks engaging in the kind of activities they've done in the past. And moreover, we want to impose affirmative obligations on them to do some good things. We want to make sure that housing loans, for example, include options for retrofitting homes for environmental purposes. And we want to make sure there's guarantees that predatory lending never occurs. And when we put these banks back in the private sector, assuming we want to do that, we want to break up these giant conglomerates, not just so that we've got commercial banking, again, independent of investment banking, but we don't want to have these giant national banks in so much concentrated power that they become too big to fail. We want to maybe break them up into 10 pieces or maybe 50 pieces. But we should have that discussion.
You know, Rob Weissman, you said even in the best of circumstances and everything works out and the banks do again become solvent and the Fed is able to sell off these troubled assets and get some decent value for them so the public doesn't have to take a bath on it. But even in that scenario, the public's going to be paying a great deal of money to keep these banks alive for their benefit. And then indirectly for our benefit, because the economy is doing better. But what happens in a worst-case scenario? Because it seems to me the best-case scenario, to some extent, is predicated in the idea that there will be a decent economic recovery. There will be people investing, people buying stuff, the economy maybe not booming, but certainly having modest growth at the very least. What happens if we have a recession like we're having now that continues and doesn't really recover? The recovery is extraordinarily weak. In the financial sector, therefore, the assets don't get their value back. The value of assets continues to tumble, and the United States is out trillions of dollars. What are we painted into a corner then? Have we used up a lot of our chips for recovery, wasted and blown, and we're sort of stuck?
Well, I think that's a realistic scenario. I don't think that the money from the Fed is in the same category as the money that the Treasury Department's putting out. So I don't think the Fed money is at risk. But I do think the scenario is they try to slog it along, and it doesn't work, and eventually they have to acknowledge the insolvency of the banks anyway, that we lose the money that we have put in, which is really substantial, hundreds of billions of dollars, that the losses are worse than they would have been if we had dealt with the problem sooner. And moreover, the weakness in the financial sector contributed to the weakness in the overall economy. In a really bad reinforcing cycle. So I think that's the worst case is not only that we just have a lingering recession and a slow recovery, but that the troubles in the financial sector make it so, and that then therefore also the weak economy makes the financial sector itself weaker.
Our guest today, Robert Weissman, the director of Essential Action, editor of Multinational Monitor. You can read his material at multinationalmonitor.org. He is talking to us by telephone from Washington, D.C. today, a few days before we went on air. We taped this program, so thank you for not calling in to sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Rob Weissman works on a full range of consumer issues. He's been focusing on the financial crisis recently and the auto bailout, but as you'll see, he covers the waterfront on crucial pocketbook issues and economic and consumer issues. Let's turn now, if we can, Rob, to the auto bailout, which you've also been working on. You've already said that the way the Obama administration and the federal government have addressed the crisis in the auto industry has been dissimilar to the way it approached the concerns of the big banks.
Yes, I think they did some good things, and I think they're on the verge of doing a number of really horrible things. The good thing was they said, we're not going to defer to the executives of these companies, and they've pushed out the CEO at GM, and they appear on the verge of pushing out the guy, Nardelli, who's running Chrysler, the other recipient of funds. They also said, we are going to have a reorganization of the company, that the way things have been going is not sustainable, and we're going to change it. And so they're saying that all of the creditors, the shareholders are going to take a massive hit. They're going to lose almost all of their equity in these companies, that the bondholders are going to be compelled to convert their bond holdings into shares, into equity, and they're not going to get a very big chunk of the company. And that in the case of GM, as it emerges from the reorganization plan, the government is going to own half of the company. The United Auto Workers are going to own a 38% share, 10 or 11% for the will go to the bondholders, and only 1% for the old shareholders. And the idea is, look, this company was going to go under, but for the public investment. So we're going to, when it comes out of it, thanks to the public investment, we're going to allocate shares in some proportion in a fair way. I think that part of it is very good. What's deeply worrisome is that, as we speak, it appears that the small task force in the Obama administration that's run by an investment bank guy and is guiding the reorganization plans to put GM into bankruptcy, maybe by shortly after June 1st or even before. That will lose control of the process, possibly, but has all kinds of really harmful potential ramifications in losing consumer confidence in General Motors as a brand. Will have a lot of harm to suppliers and put a lot of people out of work, I think, needlessly. Distinct from that, there are a number of other things they're doing that are really very hard to understand. One is they have continued, as best I understand it, the Bush administration condition that union workers at GM and Chrysler must accept wages that are comparable to the non-union wages in the Japanese transplants based in the United States. Now, over time, workers in those companies have made wages that are comparable to those of union auto workers as a way, and that was because companies like Toyota and Honda were trying to keep their plants non-union. They did that by saying, basically, we pay the same wages. So what the history has been, those wages trailed the union wages up. Now we're going to have the reverse process, where the union wages have to go down to the level of the transplant wages. There'll be nothing that props up the transplant wages, and we're going to see them driven down progressively and quickly, I think. A second really remarkable feature that is absolutely inexplicable is that in the case of GM, the reorganized company plans to increase the number of cars made overseas for the U.S. market. And it just boggles the mind to figure out why the government is supporting a reduction in manufacturing in the United States, cost of jobs, directly and indirectly. You know, it's like, to what end are we putting this money in if it's not to maintain the manufacturing capacity in the country? And then finally, they're saying that they want to operate their 50% share of the company either silently or to vote it as if they were a shareholder, that is to say, without any eye towards public objectives. And again, what's the point of doing this if it's not to preserve jobs and make cars safer and to insist that the companies transform themselves to make much more fuel-efficient autos and eventually to get rid of gasoline-powered cars altogether and to increase their investment in public transit? So there's enormous opportunity in the midst of this auto crisis to really change the direction of the industry altogether. And we can do that not just by regulation but by an ownership stake. We're going to own half of General Motors, the largest auto company in the country, and not too long ago in the world. We can change the way they operate. The administration is saying out front that they have zero interest in exercising that power.
And the explanation for this, I assume, is that they want to let free markets work their magic or something?
It's hard to understand as anything but pure corporate ideology, but it's, of course, not only is that an ideology that doesn't make a lot of sense in the first place, but it makes zero sense here where, you know, the market was going to drive the company into bankruptcy and probably into liquidation. You've got the government intervening. The question is, why is the government intervening? What public objectives was it intervening for? And shouldn't it really try to pursue those public objectives?
Are there people in Congress who are advocating your position, who are trying to make the bailout plan for General Motors and Chrysler and for the auto industry, take into consideration the need to convert the industry into something that's ecologically sensitive, keep jobs in the United States, good-paying jobs here, and really use it as the foundation for reestablishing the industrial base of this country?
It's coming really, really late in the game. What happened is the auto bailout is being done through the financial bailout monies. So when Congress voted in January to give the second piece of the $700 billion to the Obama administration, it basically handed authority over to the administration. The administration then created this grand task force, which has all kinds of cabinet officials in it, but is basically being run by the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, and Larry Summers, the economic advisor to the president, at the top level. In fact, there's three special advisors led by a guy named Steve Rattner, who's an investment bank guy, who are making all the decisions about how the future of the industry is going to go. And there's really no accountability anywhere, and certainly not to Congress. Congress has turned their eyes away from this because they thought it was complicated and they didn't want to mess around with it. Until the last few weeks, and people started to realize, actually, boy, there are real harms here, and there may be a political price to pay. The first thing that occurred was Chrysler, in midst bankruptcy, has announced more plant closings than it had led people to believe were going to take place, and has also cut ties with 700 dealers. It's not really clear what the upside to Chrysler is or to GM of cutting these ties with dealers, because it does not cost them anything to maintain the relationship with the dealers. But they do employ a lot of people, and they are spread out all across the country. They're not concentrated in the same way the auto plants are. So all of a sudden, the dealers are up in arms. They're contacting their members of Congress, and members of Congress are starting to express some worry. But we're up against a June 1 deadline for this auto task force and possible bankruptcy soon after, or maybe even before. And Congress has really delegated its authority away, and unless it aggressively asserts it, which it still could, we're going to be left to the whim of a handful of investment bankers who may wield a guillotine over the largest auto company in the United States.
I don't know if this is a little orthogonal to the points we've been talking about, Rob, but I alluded to it earlier anyway, which is, you know, can we have an industrial economy in the United States where workers aren't sort of paid, you know, really low wages, where we can have decent standard of living for the workers? Or is that simply no longer possible, or are policymakers working under the assumption that's no longer possible?
Well, I think it absolutely is possible. I also think it's necessary. I do think that one of the consequences of the growth of the financial sector over the last decade and the decline of the industrial sector, especially in the Midwest, was you had both a change in the allocation of political power, so that finance is much more powerful in Washington than the auto companies are, and really the creation of an ideology and an overall worldview that lost touch with the importance of making the real things, and a kind of fascination and infatuation with so-called financial innovation, which is really working in the virtual world about a virtual thing, money. And that's a big problem in Washington. It's going to take a big shift to get people to pay attention to what really matters. Of course, especially for Congress, at the end of the day, they do represent districts, and if the people tell them things, they will respond. They are, for example, terrified about providing any new bailout money for any purpose whatsoever, and that is only because there's such massive outrage about the bailout that was provided and the huge fury that members of Congress experienced in the course of voting on that.
Our guest, Rob Weissman. Rob, let's turn for a second, if we can, to one of the other hats you wear at Essential Action, and also I think this applies to your being editor of Multinational Monitor. One of the things you do and your group does and your publication does as well as anyone is monitor corporations, their activities, their behavior. You're quite critical of corporations. What sort of changes, if any, do you think legally we should put in place to make corporations better serve the public?
Well, I'm less oriented towards doing things to make companies better and more oriented towards trying to control the way they behave, to impose limits on what they're permitted to do, and to and also separately to displace corporations from sectors of the economy and replace the corporate structure with alternative ways of doing things. That can be, just to make that clear, on a small scale, that could be things like supporting cooperatives. But it may mean breaking up big companies and monopoly controls over industry and having much more competitive industries. Or it may mean, in the case of healthcare, for example, doing away with the private insurance industry and replacing it with a government-run program.
Mm-hmm. And in one of the things you've also worked on, I'd like to finish the show by talking about this, as it's most germane to the topic of our program, Media Matters, is the work you do with an organization called Commercial Alert. What's the history of Commercial Alert, and you are now the head of it? What does the group aim to do today? What are the issues it's working on?
Well, we started a little bit more than 10 years ago to try to address the really overwhelming problem of excessive commercialism in society. And the idea is to try to help foster a different way about thinking about commercialism and press back against a lot of the worst abuses. So we focus on all kinds of different things, the commercial incursion into schools, the expanded commercial presence in public spaces, whether it's everything from a public beach to the side of a police car, commercialization in sports, and the including the integration of a commercial culture into the media, both the news media and the entertainment media.
What do you say to the argument that, well, this is the advertising and commercialism are just the free market in action, and that really there's no role for the government to interfere?
Well, there are a variety of things to say. I mean, one is that we think that there are other values in the world besides the market and besides commercialism, so that some spaces ought to be protected, or at least relatively protected, from commercialism. And that there really are legitimately public spaces that have sort of civic objectives, and that those are distinct from commercialism. And commercial culture has plenty of space. It serves some useful purposes, but it shouldn't be the entire space. Another thing is that kids are really over-commercialized, not able to filter properly all the commercial messages they get. Younger kids often don't even understand that advertisements are advertisements, and that we ought to protect them as much as possible from commercialism, including especially in the schools. And separately, a lot of commercials are inherently deceptive in the way they're delivered and involve tricking people. We think that should stop. And finally, that even in areas where commercialism is appropriate, it doesn't mean it should override other modes of communication. And so it's one thing if someone wants to wear a T-shirt featuring the logo of their favorite company, but we think it's not a great thing when people are paid to promote some product and they don't disclose to their friends and neighbors and fellow students that they're actually going out marketing when they're saying how great this cool new shoe is that they're wearing.
Rob Weissman, the newspaper industry, and really a lot of the conventional broadcast media, too, are losing advertising. And it seems like advertising is changing as we're moving to a digital communication system. Are the concerns of commercial alert about commercial marination of the culture going to go away when people can go online and pick whatever websites they want and avoid advertising?
No, it's worse. Amazingly. I mean, I think, you know, if you just do a straight Google search and you get the little ad on the side, and Google can make an interesting argument that they're actually performing a service for you. They're giving you information that you want. Moreover, they're directing the advertisers, and it's kind of a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more what we're seeing is not that kind of model, but an integrated approach where a website that has some attractiveness for whatever reason is trying to obtain all kinds of personal information about you, the consumer, that you may not realize is going to be linked up to other information and used to market to you in the future. That often things you're getting where you're getting information are combined with commercials in ways that aren't clear and disclosed at all. Like, for example, it's almost certain that there's a lot of material on YouTube that is commercially driven without it being disclosed, that products that appear in the videos are there because of the video itself is serving as an advertisement. And there's a real effort, especially focused on kids, to be able to integrate the idea of entertainment and information provision with commercial exploitation in ways that are novel, evolving, and really quite troubling.
You know, this is an issue that, from my experience, people are interested in and generally supportive of what you're talking about, but it seems to have almost no traction, if I can be so blunt, in Washington, even compared to some of the other issues we've talked about. It's just not there. Am I inaccurate, or if I am accurate, why is that?
Well, if you mean commercialism in general?
Yeah, as a policy issue. To
Well, at the level that I'm talking about, I think no. And I think there's some sort of generally are we concerned about commercialism? The answer would be, well, what you suggested before, the market has its role. But in a lot of the specific areas, there are really high-profile disputes. Now, especially in the last last decade with both the Bush administration and the corporate market ideology run amok. It's been hard to get traction on this stuff. But if you look in the area of, for example, pharmaceutical advertising, there's increasing concern. In the area of marketing to kids, we've seen the relevant agencies sitting on their hands for the last 10 years, but I think that's actually going to change with the new administration taking over. In one area where we had petitioned the Federal Communication Commission 5 years ago, the increased use of product placements on television programs and also all kinds of product integration where programs are developed around products. It took them 5 years to get around to responding to our petition, but there's now action going on at the Federal Communications Commission. And I think in a lot of these specific areas, you do see some emerging interest, and I think the tide is turning a little bit on that. But there's no question that especially before the financial bubble burst, there really was this kind of craze around advertising and a new thrill for the internet based on all kinds of advertising and marketing models. A lot of that slowed now. People maybe are going to have a chance to take a breath and get a more realistic picture about what's going on and take a harder look about some of the abusive practices that we're beginning to see emerge. And just as one recent development, for example, Hasbro and Discovery Kids have announced they're going to start a new joint venture, the purpose of which will be to broadcast television programs built around Hasbro toys. And then they'll leverage all of that stuff on the Discovery website to draw kids in, provide their information, and get marketed to more. So that's the thing, I think, that the kind of thing that there's going to be a lot more scrutiny on during the Obama administration than there would have been during the Bush years.
Rob Weissman, we've only got about a minute left, and I just wanted to close by asking you a little bit about yourself. How long have you been working at this kind of work in Washington, and how big is your community that you work with and your groups that you're involved with? What are the prospects looking forward?
I came down to Washington right after going to college, went away to law school for a few years, came back. So I've been doing this stuff for couple of decades now, and I think in some sense, I'll tell you about our groups are small, half dozen people total going to be working with me on these different projects we've been talking about, but you know, the community in Washington, even though this is corporate occupied territory, is still pretty decent. We've got a lot of friends here, and of course there are many people around the country and around the world with whom we communicate and collaborate with. In some ways, we're facing a much more optimistic moment here with a rethinking about the deregulatory craze and the departure of the Bush administration fanatics. And so there's real opportunity that didn't exist just a few months ago.
You know,
on the other hand, things are really bleak in the financial area, yeah, and the control of economic policymaking by Geithner, Summers, and the Wall Street crew.
Rob, unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear us out of the studio so the next program can come in. Thank you so much, Rob Weissman, for joining us today, taking time from your busy schedule, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank everyone at WILL for making this show possible, and I'll be back in 167 hours. Have a great week, everyone.